Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Charles Hugh Smith. He's author, leading global finance blogger, and philosopher, America's philosopher, we call him. He's the author of 9 books on our economy and society, including A Radically Beneficial World, Automation, Technology, and Creating Jobs for All, Resistance, Revolution, Liberation, A Model for Positive Change, and The Nearly Free University and the Emerging Economy. His blog of twominds.com has logged over 55 million page views and is number 7 on CNBC's top alternative finance sites. Welcome, Charles.
Thank you, Richard. Always a pleasure to join your roundtable.
Great. And we thought today we'd do a focus on the sort of tension between the private sector and the public sector with many types of revolutions, technological revolutions happening in the private sector, you know, in terms of blockchain and biotech, energy, environment, lots of revolutions happening. Much like what happened with the internet .com revolution, and the question is, will that growth in the private sector be able to meet the challenges of the public sector in terms of seemingly unsustainable growth in debt, growth in entitlement programs? Dr. Albert Friedberg of the Friedberg Mercantile Group recently observed that in the U.S. it's basically 10% of GDP and rising for entitlement programs. So, you know, that's the big question. Your initial thoughts?
Well, Richard, I think that's an excellent context for, you know, the points we're going to make. And one of the first points I would start with is ultimately the public sector, the state, what we call the state, all layers of government and government-related entities, they all live off the private sector, right? The private sector has to generate surplus. It has to generate wages for employees. And those are taxed by the public sector. And then that's the source of the public sector's revenues. And so what we're really kind of discussing is, can the public sector generate enough profit and employment to support this fast ballooning public sector? And you mentioned the entitlements growing by 10%. And I have this chart of consumer goods and services, the price changes, what we might call inflation, but it's actually not entirely inflation. It's the cost of services being provided and how far above or below they're rising than like people's wages, which household incomes, as we all know, have been stagnating for somewhere between 40 years and 10 years, and depending on which sector of the economy you're looking at. But we look at what is soaring in price, and we look at like 200% increases, and we find out it's college tuition. And we look at what's climbing at 100% or more, and it's like healthcare and childcare. And, of course, these are the sectors that are heavily controlled or funded by the public sector. And what we find is declining in price is cell phone service, software, TVs, the kind of things that the private sector provides, right? Yeah. So it's pretty clear. When you have competition and when you have exposure to innovation, then you get lower prices, or at least you get more for your money, or there's hope that innovation will impact the consumer's either the quality of the goods they're receiving or the price of the goods and services they're receiving. So to sort of summarize, everything that the public sector controls is skyrocketing in price. And the quality is also now suspect, right? Like I've written a lot about higher education, and I have another chart here showing that literally all of the higher education student loans that are being issued are actually funded by the federal government. So it's actually the federal government is funding these private sector lenders and guaranteeing them profits to fund these students getting diplomas, which are declining in real world value, in terms of statistically what the earnings are of college graduates and so on. That's been stagnating just along with the rest of the wages. So I would propose that higher education is actually declining in its utility and value, despite the cost soaring. And many other people would make the same claim about healthcare, at least in the U.S., is that the cost keeps soaring, but the actual, measures of health of the American population continue to decline. So this is a really striking difference. I think that's really what we're talking about. This is an enormous difference between the sectors controlled by the public sector and those controlled by the private sector.
Yeah, and you've written a lot about that in terms of several industries being sort of cartelized, with special interest group lobbyists and just the interest by the government in them. Can you elaborate a bit on that?
Yeah, I think that's a great topic. If the public sector controls something like healthcare, which in the U.S. is dominated by the public sector programs, Medicare, Medicaid, and the Veterans Administration, then the way to maximize your profit is to lobby the public sector, lobby the government agency to lock in your cartel pricing. And so that's what we see, is that we see these pharmaceutical companies routinely raising prices 30, 40% or even 400%. Just on a random basis. They make no claims that they've invented something new. They've simply raised the price on an existing medication. The public sector also imposes a lot of regulations, that some of which are, of course, important and necessary, but many of which are simply, churn. They just create more work, but they're not really creating – they're not really impacting the patient in any positive way. So I have a chart here of the growth of physicians and administrators in the healthcare system. And we see that the number of physicians has been flatlined for like 40 years,
yeah.
Where the growth of administrators from about the early 90s on has ballooned up like 3,000%. There's no way that a private sector company could bloat its management by 3,000% and get away with it, unless its revenues and profits were rising even faster. And we see the same thing in, I have a chart here of the faculty and management of the University of California system, and it shows that while the faculty has risen slightly over the last 30 years from about 7,000 to about 8,500, the number of administrators has risen from about 3,000 to like 7,500. So we have these enormous ballooning of bureaucracies, all of which are really highly paid positions, right? And yet, where is the output? I mean, where's the gain in quality or in the output? And of course, there isn't any. There's none that we can measure.
Mm. And associated with this involvement by government is an increase in government debt. And if you look at just debt in general, in recent years in the developed world, it's taken more and more new debt to create $1 in GDP. I mean, this figures are something like $4, between $4 to $18. I've seen some estimates of new debt to create $1 in GDP. Your thoughts on that?
Right, right. And I just read a report from a blog that showed that China has the same very strong diminishing returns on its vast expansion of debt, that it's expanding debt at rates that are multiples of its GDP growth. And so it's also the case that even in the developing world, the same diminishing returns that you describe is the dominant reality. And of course, we have to ask, why is there such a low efficiency or low productivity rate to this new debt? And it's because there's no pressure of innovation and competition on how the governments are spending this money. And so there's really no adaptive pressure in terms of natural selection for them to find more efficient ways to do whatever it is they're doing, right? The pressure is simply to raise more revenues, and if they can't do that, then to borrow more money. And this is where financial repression comes in, because the only way the public sector can keep adding debt at this fantastic clip is to lower interest rates to zero or near zero and create all these perverse incentives for speculation that we're seeing now. As a result of that manipulation, if you will, or intervention to keep interest rates low enough so the public sector can keep borrowing and borrowing and borrowing to infinity.
Any ideas on what the end game could be here if we consider the level of debt and the level of interest rates as sort of two levers? With rising debt, at some point, even small increases in interest rates could be disastrous. Where does this all end?
Right. I just saw a statistic, which I can't verify, of course, but it sounds fairly close to me. Somebody said that the 0.6% rise in the U.S. Treasury yields, that's a kind of recent rise in one part of the Treasury bond yield spectrum, generated $1.7 trillion in losses right then and there. Just a relatively modest increase in only one part of the total global bond market created almost $2 trillion in losses. If we extrapolate the possibility of interest rates going up 2 or 3%, then you're talking about losses that could be in the, $10 trillion and up. In the bond market. And then, of course, as yields rise, historically people sell stocks with low dividend yields and high risk, they take the benefit of the higher yield in bonds. And so stock markets tend to go down when interest rates go up as well. The end game there is, can they keep creating debt at a fast enough rate as the returns on that debt continue diminishing? And by some measures, as you know, that some people feel the return is already negative. Like there's, by the time you include debt service and other factors, then actually we're losing ground here.
Yeah.
Eventually that will erode the real economy. And I think that's really what we're talking about here is, can the private sector outgrow the debt that's being piled up by the public sector? And I have a chart here. It's kind of interesting that shows the adoption rates of technologies. And it goes back into the 19th century and shows how long it took for electricity and telephony and radio and so on to be adopted by the general populace. And, of course, as we all know from our own experience, the adoption rates are speeding up for things like cell phones and the internet itself and social media. And so we're seeing like a faster rate of adoption and development in the private sector. And we're seeing like glacial change in the public sector or actual resistance to any kind of innovation or change. And so I think one of the end games is that people, the taxpayers, might just simply be run out of patience with having to pay higher taxes for lower quality public services, right? And this could be a problem because, as we all know, public pensions are many of them are not really solvent. And they're based on unrealistic expectations of earning 7.5%, forever. and the number of people pulling the pensions, drawing on the pension funds is rising fast as the boomers retire and so on. And so it's not just entitlements, but the entire pension system, public and private, is under pressure as boomers retire and the wages of the millennials and the younger workers remain stagnant. So there's a whole other dynamic here that, the public sector is going to be forced to borrow trillions more to make up these shortfalls in pension funds, if it's going to meet all those promises on top of the public entitlements of, you know, social welfare, social security, healthcare, and so on. So yeah, there's a number of pressures building, and what's the end game? It's anybody's guess, but if you destroy or fatally wound the real economy, then there's no way that borrowing more is going to fix what's broken.
So you think none of these revolutions in terms of like blockchain and biotech and others is strong enough or deep enough to overcome what the general trend is in the public sector?
Well, it's an excellent question, Richard. Because I mean, my book that I wrote about higher education, and the nearly free university, the tools to dramatically reduce the cost of a college education are already in hand.
Yes.
And of course, this is not just remote learning, but it's also, in my mind, the key is not just, remote learning and taking the best, of what's available and making it available to students digitally, but there's a lot of possibilities for public-private sector apprenticeships, which are much lower cost than supporting this gigantic campus with a huge bureaucracy and 42 deans of student affairs and this whole tremendously expensive infrastructure. The what actually is the most effective way to learn is to get out there in the real world and augment your book learning or your lecture learning or your lab work with actual experience in the field. And of course, this is how it works with the construction industry and many other trades, but it also works just as well in the scientific community. And I know for many of our young friends who graduated with degrees in biology or computer sciences, they discover that they really don't know what the employers really need them to know. And so that's just one example of the kind of revolution that could occur in public funded sectors if the sector allows innovation. And so it's like, how do we break down the resistance of the status quo and the insiders who are benefiting? And I don't know that we can, but at some point when a system becomes completely unaffordable, then people will flock to some new alternative. And, healthcare, as another example, people might just start going around the existing public sector and buying their own healthcare services at 10% of the cost of the official public sector fund. So, there's definitely a battle royale, over these sectors that are bloated, inefficient, super high cost, and increasingly unaffordable. And so, I'm hoping that it's like a log jam, that is blocking the river of innovation and lower costs, that something will break that log jam. And, exactly what that could be would have to be some public sector agency or state agency that broke away from the status quo and accepted a much lower cost model. And that's what I hope for.
Could there also be maybe a geographic solution to this in terms of certain countries promoting innovation, like Chile has a program to encourage innovation with new immigrants, some, could there be that type of solution? Maybe new countries that take on more innovation that are regulatory friendly to business, so that perhaps there's brain drain and wealth drain from the more stressed countries that we're talking about.
That's a great dynamic that you're describing, and it also works within within regions like the EU or the United States or North America.
Yes.
And so yeah, so I think that's probably the most likely vector or trajectory for real change is somebody somewhere allows or encourages the kind of innovations we're talking about, and they start reaping these tremendous rewards, and capital and talent then are attracted to those places, and as they drain away from the high cost places like Illinois and California and some of the developed nations as a whole, then those places have their tax bases reduced, their profits generated by their private sector go down as talent and capital flees. And so then there is a kind of Darwinian competition that the really high cost, sclerotic, bureaucratic, unfriendly to business and innovation places become insolvent. And then they're forced to change, or they just wither away. So that's an excellent point. And I think that blockchain is another example of that dynamic, that whatever country fully legalizes blockchain technologies and cryptocurrencies, like Japan appears to be doing, and in sort of baby steps, even the US appears to be integrating the cryptocurrencies into its investment sort of scheme, those countries will prosper compared to countries that are trying to ban cryptocurrencies and blockchain or limit them or co-opt them, like make a public sector version and force everybody to use it. Those kind of attempts to stave off innovation will definitely fail, and there'll be a Darwinian selection process. Whether that's really not controllable because you can't really force people to work hard, and you can't force them to put their money in places that the money is treated badly.
Could the reaction by governments be similar to what has recently happened, or actually, and what is happening in Spain, for example, like with Catalonia? Could that be a blueprint for what is to come in terms of preventing brain drain, wealth drain, the sort of the within the regions? Do you see that potential?
Yeah, definitely. That what we're talking about to some degree here, of course, is financial repression that the public sector manipulates interest rates and yields and tries to subvert, ban, or limit innovative technologies like blockchain. And then, of course, that what you're describing, that financial repression, if that isn't enough, then they move to direct political repression. And one of my favorite quotes, and I'm paraphrasing here, was from Napoleon Bonaparte, and who is reputed to have said something along the lines of, "What amazes me most is how little power can it actually achieve." In other words, if you're going to use force, it's remarkable how little force can actually accomplish. Because you're having to monitor and enforce something that's unpopular. That's a tremendously high cost venture. And so that's a good way to go broke, is trying to force people to do something they don't really want to do, and that doesn't benefit them. And so I think if we had to summarize what we're talking about, it's that the public sector is its default setting is to try to force everybody through financial and political repression or propaganda to do what benefits the public sector and its cartels and fiefdoms. But you really don't. You can't change anything unless you create a benefit for people that they want to adopt the new change or adopt the innovation. They want to, they, because it benefits them in some broad fashion. So, and that's really the battle we're talking about between the public sector, which tends to want to force everybody to do what benefits itself and its insiders, and the public sector, which realizes the only way you're going to sell anything, whether it's an idea or a concept or a product or a service, is if it benefits the consumer and the citizen. So, and of course, you know, anybody from the outside, we would look at the public sector and go, why don't they accept a more public, a private sector mentality? Why don't they understand they have to generate additional benefits for people, not by borrowing more money to pay for like a bloated, inefficient, corrupt system, but to foster and encourage innovation that lowers the price of goods and services because it's more productive. So that's really kind of the battle that's being played out, I think, throughout the world.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's great insight, Charles, as always. How can our listeners learn more about your work?
Please visit me at oftwominds.com. There's free chapters of my book and thousands of various rants and essays.
Okay, great. Thank you very much, Charles. We'll do it again next month.
Okay, thank you, Richard.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.